Hello, I'm Eamon.
I'm Conrad.
And I'm Troy.
And we are...
Mega City Film Club!
It's the Film Club again, and we're welcoming back Troy Martin, making his fourth appearance on Mega City Book Club, second appearance in the Film Club, because 2 years ago, we went to the movies and watched E.T. and Runaway. One of the films made us cry, ill and not so much, but exciting stuff then, Troy.
Yeah, that was good fun, and it's good to be back, and it's good to be here with both of you guys again.
Well, thank you very much. And of course, for suggesting a film, or rather perhaps a filmmaker, regular listeners will probably know what's coming up because you and I did talk about it when we did Lawless. But anyway, we're sticking with a favourite filmmaker, one that we previously done a Film Club episode about with Giles Richards when we did the Escape from Films. So let's start. Conrad, take us into...
Film 1, Assault on Precinct 13.
So this is from 1976, written, directed, edited, and scored by John Carpenter. He was very much a one-man band then. Starring Austin Stoker, John Carpenter's next-door neighbour, Darwin Jostin, Laurie Zimmer, and Tony Burton. I think we know which film we're going to get to second, Troy, but I think you suggested that we add in another... John Carpenter film. Why did you add this one in?
I think John Carpenter's films generally have had a bit of an influence on John Wagner in particular, but Assault and Precinct 13 has been kind of, it found its way into Judge Dredd. So the last arc of the story, The Pit, where they're holed up in a disused sector house and they're surrounded by the criminal gang, is clearly very much lifted from Assault on Precinct 13.
So, yes, okay. Well, we will be... I mean, that's the connection to 2000 AD, but we need the setup, of course, Conrad. So I need to ask you to give us, what is Assault on Precinct 13 about?
Assault on Precinct 13, the gang that swore a blood oath to destroy Precinct 13 and every cop in it. It's Los Angeles. It's the fictional town of Anderson, Los Angeles. There is an Anderson, California, but it's in like Shasta up in the north where it's all redwood trees and stuff like that. Doesn't really matter. There's a gang that's stolen a bunch of military grade weapons. The cops have taken out a bunch of them in like an ambush. And so the leaders of the gang have poured a bunch of their own blood into a bowl in a shared theme between these two films that we're talking about today. But in this case, they've decided to swear out the Cholo, which is a rite of revenge against the local police station. And this leads them to the titular Precinct 13, which is a police station that's been, it's sort of in the process of being decommissioned. It's like the last night that it'll be open. So like there's very few people there. There's like a couple secretaries and Lieutenant Austin Stoker, who's Ethan Bishop, who's sort of like, it's like his first night on the job. They've given him like a very lame assignment, basically just to close out this station. But little does he know that it'll be the most exciting night of his life. And then also they get a prison convoy. It has to stop there briefly, and which leads to them also being joined by a prisoner, Napoleon Wilson, who's played by Darren Johnson. Austin Stoker plays Ethan Bishop. It's a whole thing. Anyway, sorry, I got it mixed up. Anyway, basically, there's a couple people, there's like them and a couple secretaries, and they just get attacked by like zombie-like hordes of street gang guys with silenced guns. And there's some really great scenes of just all the glass in the police station being destroyed without gunshots. Just like you see the glass breaking sort of out from nowhere and stuff, and really, I think a really neat thing. But basically, they, in a series of increasingly intense situations, they hold off the attacking hordes, and there's intrigue and various cool things. And like, yeah, it's just a fun action romp in an hour and a half.
Fantastic. So it is a classic base under siege. some disparate individuals in the base, and as you say, these sort of like zombie-like multiracial band of gang that has sworn a blood oath. Troy, so early on in John Carpenter's career, one of his first films, and an amazingly tight 20-day shooting schedule with a minimal budget. What do you make of this film? How does that play out on the film, on the screen?
I think it definitely has kind of an edgy, almost punk kind of sensibility to it. But I think it's fair to say that this is a genuine bona fide pulp classic movie. And it's low budget, but it doesn't matter because it's not an awful lot of need for special effects and stuff like that. You've got a relatively unknown cast. I don't know what Austin Stoker had done prior to this. I know Darren Jostin was in a couple of other John Carpenter films. He's the medical examiner in The Fog. He appears in that. Martin West, probably the most well-known actor in it, who plays the cop who's leading the prison convoy.
He's the guy who goes on to be the sheriff in Halloween, isn't he?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think he was like a TV actor and what have you. So he's probably like the most well-known face in it, I assume. Mm. But yeah, it's a very tight, very compact film, perfect pacing, tons of action, some really cool lines, really cool characters in it. It's a Western, basically, and it is sort of a remake of Rio Bravo. And John Carpenter has said that, sort of somewhat tongue-in-cheek, he said that basically all his films are basically just a remake of Rio Bravo.
Right. And Rio Bravo, that's the one with John Wayne and Dean Martin.
Angie Dickinson.
Western actor. What's his name? Brennan, I think. They're stuck in a sort of defending a prison, aren't they? In the horror, yeah.
Yeah, they're in the sheriff's office and the local gang kind of surround them at the end. So it's a very similar sort of premise, but I think of the two, I genuinely prefer Assault and Precinct 13. I think it's I don't want to go as far as say it's a better film, but it's a much more enjoyable romp.
Yeah, and an amazing... I think the cast in Assault and Precinct 13 do amazing stuff. Conrad, of course, you've mentioned him. We've got the lieutenant who's having a very bad day at work. But also we've got this incredibly memorable character of the criminal, the killer, the convicted killer, Napoleon Wilson, who's been transferred along with some other guys from one prison to another and ends up in the precinct and helping out. What do you make of the character of Napoleon Wilson?
I mean, they really try to like make him be very cool, I think. You know, he's always literally every constantly asking if people have cigarettes and stuff like that, that I think is a decent, like sort of presages, I think, later Carpenter characters also, that sort of Snake Plissken, anybody got a smoke, that kind of situation. And just kind of this, what you kind of want in a Pope action character, of just sort of someone who's like, you know, seems pretty competent actually, who sort of is in the situation sort of like, all right, things are tough, here's the plan. That kind of character, I guess. Something I think is really interesting is just generally, I guess, is that in Assault and Precinct 13 is that there's a lot of subplots that are just kind of left on the table, I guess. If you made this movie an hour long, like or longer, then you could have there's room for sort of just having people talk about their backstories and learning about things, you know, a running thing of like people keep asking Wilson, like, how's a guy like you get a name like Napoleon, right? And he never actually says, like, he just kind of like keeps putting it off and stuff. You know that he's a killer, you know, he's like done crimes, but and that people, when they hear his name or see him, they're like, whoa, it's that guy, but you don't really get the details of it, right? Similarly, it seems like there's like history for like Lieutenant Bishop of that he's got something going on, that he's being kind of hazed with this new job or something, but they don't really talk about it that much either. even stuff that I forget it, like the main like secretary kind of talks about, like, I've been working with cops for 5 years, so I'm pretty tough. And they don't really, but you know, they don't give you details of that either. And I think it's really interesting. Similarly, again, like I've sort of called them zombies and stuff, but the street, you know, you don't get any theory of like what's really going on with like the gang members. You see them swear the oath, but like they barely even like say anything when they do that, you know? And there's never like a, and then once the assault begins, they don't, you don't hear them talk at all, basically. Like no, they don't, you know, there's never, they don't negotiate, justify themselves or anything. They're just constantly there. And I think that really makes the movie, it gives the movie a lot of like weight, or like it makes it, those sort of little mysteries, I think, keep you really paying attention to things. I think it's really interesting.
You mentioned that the gang get almost no dialogue. Troy, John Carpenter is writing the script. He does do some great dialogue. Most of it, he gives the best lines to Napoleon Wilson, doesn't he?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because I think, and I'll touch on this again when we talk about the second film, but I think a lot of John Carpenter's films, the screenplay, the dialogue in particular, is, it's not like realistic and conversational. Like, you know, for example, Jaws, the scenes in that where it's almost like fly on the wall documentary style. You could be watching real people talking the way real people do. Whereas with John Carpenter, his characters are all sort of larger than life. And the dialogue is that as well. It feels very 1950s television or comic book or pulp novel kind of dialogue. And it's almost as if, I don't know if it's deliberate and if he does that on purpose. So it's like, this isn't real life. This is just entertainment. So you don't have to take it too seriously. I think it's kind of cool. And like you say, the characters in it are all very, he's gone out of his way to make them very cool. Even Lee, the secretary, she's like the female equivalent of Napoleon. She's just cool and deadpan and just takes everything in a stride. Even when she gets shot, she doesn't even flinch. She's just like walking around with a bullet in her arm.
Yeah.
I put this in our notes. I got this real vibe from Napoleon Wilson and the Secretary Lee Brackett of Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. The real sort of like classic Hollywood golden power couple. And Their characters, I think, are similar. You know, these tough, resourceful, wisecracking people who are very good in a crisis, like Lieutenant Bishop's Daryl there at work. So, yeah, I really enjoyed. I think they're terrific. I'm surprised Laurie Zimmer more or less disappeared after this film. I mean,
yeah, it's a shame.
Yeah, but Darwin Jostin did go on to do some other stuff, as you say. So it zips along. It's 90 minutes. It's base under siege. You've already sort of connected it to 2000 AD for us, because I asked you guys both about some good base under siege storylines from 2000 AD. Troy, you mentioned The Pit already. Were there some others as well that you saw similarities to?
Yeah. So the very first Judge Dredd story I ever read when I picked up Prog 303 had, there was a story running in it called Shantytown, and that's Judge Dredd and the group of judges are shot down in the cursed earth. I think they're flying in a stolen Strato V, one of the Solf crafts, and they're surrounded by a gang, and one of the gangs got a stub gun. You know, so that's kind of, it's not a base, it's a crashed aircraft, but they're defending that against the invaders. There's,
you mentioned Lawless, which we did, yeah, of course, on the book club.
Yeah, so we talked about Lawless just a few weeks ago, and I think it's in the second arc of that when the town of Bad Rock is under siege, and it's basically like the Alamo. They're surrounded by this massive army, and they've got to defend themselves from this huge sort of corporate army and all these mercenaries. And there's, you know, there's been other examples. I think Conrad, you mentioned one from the earlier progs, didn't you?
Yeah, like I mentioned, like the Black Plague, which is this one where there's sort of a giant invasion of spiders that Dredd has to hold like a cursed earth town against and stuff. Like, I'll mention not so much sieges, but like just generally, like, just the gang in this movie feels very Mega City One, I guess, or just sort of this, like, this idea of that I think is so inherent to the Mega City. You've got regular people living like workaday lives and stuff like that. I mean, we sort of haven't mentioned, but there's this like a sub, like the opening subplot is this dude and his daughter who are like, I guess they're going to like talk to the daughter's nanny to have her like come move in with them because she's like living alone in this like dangerous neighborhood and the little girl gets shot and stuff like that. And I think that's sort of, there's a lot of Judge Dredd stories that are sort of mega citizens who might have sort of very like normal, relatable lives sort of periodically coming up against this like seedy, ultra violent underbelly that's also present in Mega City and kind of, and just like the culture clash in there, or like sort of them like having to deal with that, I guess.
Yeah, I think I was just going to say, yeah, I totally agree with you there. And I think with the very first time I watched it, which I think for me would have been sometime in the early 90s when it was on Videodrome on the telly. And I very much got that vibe, what you just described there with the gang feeling very sort of Mega City One, that they could almost have been drawn by Ron Smith.
Absolutely. They're like three knee pads away from just being ready for Mega City One, basically. But I'm thinking about like there's a story about a couple who have a what do they call it? Like an RV that gets like that, like they take the wrong off ramp and get trapped and sort of Dredd and have to like hold off attackers while, you know, Dredd comes to save them and stuff like that. Mm. There's a lot of these little things that, and that feels very familiar, just that there are these sort of just like, you know, violent gangs just ready to sort of devour you if you sort of take the, you know, walk in the wrong place or aren't too careful or something like that. That feels very like the basis of what Dredd has to deal with in Mega City One constantly.
Mm. So it does feel like a very John Wagner story. It feels like John Wagner has seen this film. So 1976, it's 90 minutes long, it's got this great concept, it's got this wonderful cast and some extremely memorable lines, which are just terrific. I'll put my cards on the table straight away and say I love this film. I think this film is terrific. Troy, where would you put it? First of all, what do you think about it? And where would you put it in Carpenter's run of remarkable successes?
I love this film. I've seen it so many times. I know it inside out. It's definitely one of my favorite John Carpenter films. It's in the top five, if not the top three, for me. I just wanted to say, talking about the gang, again, just bringing it back to that briefly, it's very interesting that the gang in this very deliberately are a multiracial gang, because of course American street gangs are quite often, you know, you have the Mexican gang, the black gang, the Italian gang, the Irish gang. You don't necessarily get these multicultural gangs like is shown in this film. And it is mentioned in the film that it's unusual. So you get this feeling that it's almost like there's something in the water that's infected this area. And Conrad, you said earlier that they feel like almost like zombies. And it does give you that feeling, because obviously it's, you know, you've got the assault, literally the assault on the precincts, and, you know, it is, you know, like the Rio Bravo, but it also feels like Night of the Living Dead, especially like you said, when they're shooting up the station with the silencers. So you're just getting like explosions and glass breaking and rims of paper being blown up into the air as bullets are hitting them, but you can't hear the gunshots. And so it gives you that sort of creeping sense of tension, like a horror film, even though it's not actually a horror film.
Conrad, you like this film?
Yeah, that was great. Listen, after a couple duds that we've had on the film club, Transformers not, you know, Transformers accepted, like we've had some rough ones, and just to sit down to kind of just an hour and a half of blasting dudes with shotguns and dropping some witty lines and stuff like that, this is just a lot of fun. and just like very much a great time, just a great time to be had, just in terms of just, yeah, like a nice, tight, taut action movie, you know, ooh, that really that hits the bases and just does what you want it to do.
It zips along. I know I keep mentioning it, but it's only 90 minutes. It's currently streaming on Amazon Prime here in the UK. I have seen the remake, the Ethan Hawke and Lawrence Fishburne remake, but not recently. I didn't like it. I can't really remember much about it, and I couldn't find it to rewatch this time. So I don't know. I don't think either of you have seen the remake, have you?
I have not.
I would not recommend. However, for Assault on Precinct 13 from 1976, it's three thumbs up, I'm guessing, here on
absolutely on film club. Yeah,
I'm giving it two, so that's two. Four.
That's four. Okay. It's wonderful. If you've not seen it, like I say, it's streaming online, and it's really terrific stuff. It doesn't really waste much time getting going either, does it?
And an awesome soundtrack as well. The theme music is superb.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, John Carpenter's doing the soundtrack again. And yeah. It's just another banger from him. Okay, so that's Assault on Precinct 13. Let's turn to the main event. Let's don our warmest parkas and head down south. Conrad, take us to...
Film 2, The Thing.
1982, written by Bill Lancaster, directed by John Carpenter, scored by Ennio Morricone this time, cinematography Dean Cundey, the special effects by Rob Bottin, starring Kurt Russell, Keith David, Rich Dysart, Wilfred Brimley, and a load of cold, very, very cold guys. Now, Troy, over to you. This was obviously one that you talked about when we did Lawless. I think you'd like to talk about this film. Let's start with the setup. What is the setup of one of the greatest films ever made?
So you've got a team of researchers in a US government outpost in the Antarctic, and they uncover a very sinister, I was going to say plot, it's not a plot. Basically, they uncover a spaceship, and they get stalked by a shape-shifting alien. There's all kinds of tension and paranoia and body horror galore. There's dogs being torn apart. There's tentacles. There's everything you can ask for in a sci-fi horror and more.
Fantastic stuff. Now, Troy, you've also done The Slightly Impossible. I should say, by the way, that Troy's wearing his Outpost 31 t-shirt for this recording, which, of course, hey, we just can't see. You've done The Impossible because you've snuck another horror film past Conrad's radar.
No, listen, I knew what the thing was. You know, I believe you tested the waters with me, and I was like, yeah, I'll watch. It's fine. Whatever.
Have you seen it before, Conrad?
I'd seen like parts of it and stuff like that. You know, like very much, you know, had to be behind the couch for this one a little bit. But yeah, this is a good time still, but is very scary. Although I think actually this is one of the many special effects based horror movies where advances in digital screening processes have helped to make things a little bit less scary because the effects are a little bit more obvious, I think they might have been on the original film grain or the original definition levels, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. We'll talk about the special effects in just a moment. Troy, you mentioned paranoia. Based on the original short story by Joseph Campbell, who, of course, is one of those people who inspired George Lucas and all the Star Wars films. In the original short story, they do have, of course, this idea that the thing looks like the person who you were sitting with the day before, so you can't tell. As we know, there's a 1951 film where he's basically, the thing is just this large walking carrot, which is... takes away. What about this version? Does it give you that sort of paranoia, that sort of suspicion, that sort of these blokes being tense and tired and they're all at the end of their tethers? What do you think of all that?
I think it's brilliant. I think I talked about the script in Assault on Precinct 13 and the dialogue in that. This is John Carpenter, this is his finest moment. It's the story, the script, the dialogue, the acting, the direction, the cinematography, the special effects, everything in this is turned up to 11. It's definitely his masterpiece, in my opinion. Yes, and you know, he's a master of tension and suspense, and he ramps that up to 11 in this as well. And the paranoia is visceral. You can almost touch it. It's, you know, it's with you there the whole time, and with everyone on the screen the whole time. And the pacing as well. It's again another film that just flies by. The pacing is immense. Like within the first 20 minutes, you get to see the creature in that scene in the kennels. And it usually with monster films, you don't get to see the monster till the end in the thing. You see it within the first 20 minutes. And it's like, oh my God, what am I watching?
Conrad, one of the things about scripting and action films and horror films is to give your lead characters a sort of deadline and then to ramp things up and make, you know, so that things get worse before the deadline. Things certainly get worse for the blokes in Outpost 31 as this film progresses.
That's, yeah, to say the least. I mean, what's funny is that it seems like you've got this shape-shifting monster, this idea that it is slowly killing and replacing everybody. And so literally the deadline is just, is any of us going to be left, you know?
And of course, as several characters express, should there be anybody left because of the risk of this getting back to main civilization?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's definitely one of these, I mean, something that I think we can sort of all have a, you know, more of an idea of, I guess, post COVID or something, this idea that if there is just a sickness that travels from person to person, that's highly infectious and deadly, at what point do you have to kind of be like, well, like it has to end with us or something, like it can't get any further than that, you know? But in this case, it's even worse because it's a big, crazy tentacle monster kind of thing, which that's much worse. You don't want that at all.
And Troy, special effects, big, crazy tentacle monsters, groundbreaking practical effects by Rob Bottin. I know that he was a very young guy and that he found it quite a stressful process. I think he was in hospital for some time during or after making this film. But what do you make of these practical effects for The Thing and its amazing multiforms?
They're just superb. It really is like the pinnacle of animatronics and practical effects, and you know the level of skill and expertise of Rob Bottin to make this stuff happen, and you know, like the spider head scene and the defibrillator scene later in the film, and it's like unbelievable. The model making is just beyond comprehension. I love practical effects. I'm not a big fan of CGI. If they made it these days, it would almost certainly be CGI. We'll probably talk a bit about the sequel, I imagine, or the prequel rather. But I think what you don't get with CGI, which is, even if it's very, very good CG effects, it's still basically just pixels on a screen. Animated imagery, whereas with the practical effects, it's again, it's visceral. It's there. It's interacting with the set. It's interacting with the actors, and it allows you to suspend your disbelief more effectively, I think, than a lot of CGI does. So you're aware that you're watching models, but they're so disgusting. It doesn't matter. It freaks you out anyway.
Do you have a favourite of the various set-piece practical effects in this film? Because there's many.
There's so many. I've always loved the scene with the dogs in the kennel, because that's the first time, and it's such a shocking moment. And, you know, to see the dogs, you know, that dog's its head splits open and all this stuff comes out. So that's possibly my favourite. But then, yeah, the defibrillator scene and everything that happens, like, it just goes, it just escalates and keeps escalating. And you're thinking, it can't get any worse, can it? And it does.
Conrad, which were the ones that had you diving behind the sofa?
Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, definitely the defibrillator was like, that was a real shock just because I wasn't expect, like when, you know, when his hands go through, that's really, woo, that is a shocking thing generally, I guess. But like, I'll mention also, yeah, the kennel scene, that actually scene feels really influential to me, I guess, because I feel like that sort of thing of how the skin from the dog's head sort of like unpeels in a couple different directions like that feels like stuff that you see in a lot of other creature effects things. I'm thinking of, I don't know, like I know like Blade had vampires that did that, or like in Stranger Things also, like those sort of like the guys in the upside down, those sort of, yeah, the heads that are sort of peeled back like that. Yeah. Like feels very, yeah, like of just a, like of a thing. I think one that I think is maybe a small one is when Wilford Brimley kills the cat, the
Harry, with the fingers.
Yeah, that old guy. And he just like reaches into his face and you see him like stretching out parts of like his skin and stuff like that. Oh, that's just real. Like somehow, even though that's not as like over the top and stuff, that one was real, like if I thought it was real, like you could kind of imagine what that feels like a little bit more. And so I think that was really effective. And just generally, like I think also a lot of just the models, and like I love the way that they, you know, warp like the body, make them look like the guy, like the person that it's the doppelganger of, that's been like warped and changed, but you can still see like, you know, the actor's face, like sort of inside the big mass of tissue and stuff like that. All those sorts of things are just make it be really terrifying, make it feel really real, I think, as well.
I'll also shout out the blood test scene with the guys tied to the couch and Kurt Russell on peerless form. An incredibly tense sequence. Again, suspicion, paranoia. Guys who've all had enough of each other tied to a terrible couch as well.
Yeah, that's why if I'm in that situation, I'm demanding separate chairs.
Yes.
You know, no thank you.
Yeah, so, if one of us might be the thing, I don't want to be tied to the couch with them. Yeah.
No. Yeah, everyone gets their own, you know.
And that scene as well, like, is probably the scene that makes me feel the least comfortable whenever I watch it, because the way they use the scalpel to cut the thumb to get the blood out. So does it have to be that deep?
It's true. I was thinking that too, actually. Like, you guys are gonna have to do stuff around the base after that. You can't have like giant cut in your thumb like that. That's ridiculous. Plus, isn't like one cell enough to like spread the contagion, and you guys are all using the same knife and not like disinfecting in between? Like, I'm just saying, you know? Like, it's very, very 1982 way of doing things here, guys. Come on, you know?
So it is 1982. 2000 AD has already started. It's in its golden age period in 1982. Troy, the connections between The Thing and the galaxy's greatest comic, what do you see as sort of influences from this film?
I think just generally it feels like that's a film that everyone that was writing 2000 AD during the that sort of early 80s golden era would have probably have seen it and loved it. I feel like it's had a bit of an influence on John Wagner and Alan Grant and Pat Mills in particular. We've definitely seen elements of The Thing in The Prog and in Judge Dredd. I mean, the story that springs to mind is the Starborn Thing?
Starborn Thing, yeah. Hmm.
Yeah, which, you know, it's not a shape-shifting alien, but it's like a mind control alien, and that's like a tentacle monster as well. There are a few other examples, but yeah, I think just tonally, visually, and you know, and just having that sci-fi horror element, it feels like it's just sort of, there's a lot of connected DNA there.
And Conrad, I was thinking of Brett Ewan's artwork. I was thinking, I've been recently rereading Zenith, and that's sort of like, you know, this idea of the Loiger, and who is rogue or whatever, or who's a traitor. What about you? Did you see any other sort of connection? Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I mean, I think to that, you know, there's a fair amount of like of your sort of doppelganger, like who's who sort of stories in 2000. Those come a fair amount. And a lot of future shocks about isolation and stuff, those happen. I know in a fairly recent one, I think Future Shock that we did on Space Spinner actually specifically has a Thing reference, because it's like a bunch of like guys on a spaceship like doing like VR games or something, and the first one is basically the plot of the Thing, but someone like realizes, says, oh, I've seen this one. It becomes a shape-shifting monster. It's like, oh, stop spoiling it. And then they like reenact Alien instead or something like that. I think also, you know, you see a lot of it, yeah, in like a lot of the body horror stuff. I'm really thinking of another recent one we've done on Space Spinner, Mambo, which just has a ton of like sort of tentacles and goopy flesh and stuff like that, that feels very, some maybe mixed with other stuff as well, but certainly parts of the Thing mixed in there as well. You know, anytime there's eyes where eyes shouldn't be, I feel like you're sort of looking at the Thing a little bit, you know.
Now, before I ask you to sort of put this in the rankings of the John Carpenter movies, I've got this thing in our notes, because 1982, a spectacular year in cinema. I'll mention Blade Runner, Conan the Barbarian, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, 48 Hours, Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, Poltergeist, The Elephant Man, Dark Crystal, and slightly more obscure Basket Case. Now, Troy, famously, The Thing didn't find an audience initially when it came out, although it's gone on to be regarded quite rightly as a cult classic. We were talking before we recorded, there's another Alien in 1982, isn't there?
Yeah, and we talked about that one on the film club last time I was here, which is E.T. So they were released around the same time, and the general consensus is that one of the reasons The Thing failed at the box office was because people didn't want to see a nasty alien monster. They wanted to see the cute, friendly alien.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, and I think something else as well that you said there about, I think it was you, Conrad, mentioned COVID-19. I think it's it felt during lockdown that The Thing was like the perfect analog movie for everything everyone was living at that moment. And I'll always say this, I insist that The Thing is a Christmas movie. So it always goes on my Christmas viewing list as well. Because it's got snow in it, you know.
It's got this,
yeah, all these people stuck indoors and not getting along with each other, and, you know, and the weather's crap outside. Yeah, so it feels very Christmassy.
There's some gooey explosions going on in the kitchen. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to guess that Troy thinks this is one of the best films ever made, like I do. Conrad, you're the sort of non-horror fan. What do you make of The Thing? Did you enjoy it?
I thought it was great. Yeah, definitely. I mean, we haven't talked about it actually, but I want to mention also like the score and the sound design of the movie also, that I think really has some like sort of, there's a lot of just sort of like, even just like playing like a single chord over and over again that makes things just feel so like tense and visceral as well. But also just like the design of like the creature noises and stuff like that. I think that, you know, with the right music, I think you could make The Thing be pretty silly, because sometimes there are just kind of a bunch of like little tentacles that go blah, 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 like that, which could be really silly. But instead you have this like, you know, horrifying scream with it, and it becomes the scariest thing you've ever seen, you know? And I think that that's really like a really great piece of design work on that case. Yeah, this movie is scary. It's tense. It really makes you want to know what's going to happen next. It really has you, that classic horror movie thing of being like, ah, God, like something's going to happen. And then there's like a loud noise. You jump, and it's, I'll mention there's very few like cat scares, I guess, in The Thing. Like that's where like you get really tense, and then, oh, it's just a cat or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, with Thing, you get like we mentioned the blood test scene where things are so tense and so, You know, you're on the edge of your seat, and then the blood's positive, and it screams, and he drops it, and like, oh, like that's scary. But then it just goes from like that to like 10 times worse, and everything goes wrong, you know? And like, though, all those moments are, it just, it sticks with you. All these moments that are just so scary and terrifying, and just, yeah, it's a great experience. It's a great film and a great watch for sure.
Ennio Morricone score, and as you say, Conrad, the moment when the Benin's thing is kneeling in the snow, half transformed, and opens its mouth and makes this ungodly, unearthly noise. It's quite terrifying.
Yeah, that sounds like shivers through your spine, doesn't it?
Yeah.
We should also mention that it's a great ensemble cast with this as well. I generally don't think there'll ever be another film like it. I think it's one of, if not the most unique films of the 20th century, and I don't think they'll ever come close to making that again. It's just like lightning in a bottle, and it breaks so many rules as well, because like I say, you've got that ensemble cast, all male cast, no female characters, no love interest, nobody has a backstory, there's no kind of side quests or subplots. It's just this creeping sense of dread and existentialism, and I think it's a perfect film, and for me it's the Citizen Kane of horror films.
One of your favorite films of all time?
I'd say it's one of one. Yeah.
And where does it rank in your John Carpenter top five?
It's number one for me. It's my favorite John Carpenter film. It's my favorite film, full stop. And I think it's, as I said earlier, I think it's genuinely John Carpenter's best moment in movies. Like everything, all the ducks were in a line. Everything was just perfect for that.
I think I'm putting The Thing at number one. I'm going to probably say Assault on Precinct 13 at the moment. It's number two. Mm. Then I'd go Halloween, Escape from New York, and maybe The Fog. What about you? What would you put in your five?
I think my top five would be these two films plus The Fog, Prince of Darkness.
Oh, yeah.
And Escape from New York. I think that's my top five. Right. And an honorary shout out to a lesser known John Carpenter film that often flies under the radar, but I've got a pretty big soft spot for, and that's Christine.
Oh, yes. Yeah, of course, to Stephen King. Yeah. Terrific. Conrad, do you have a John Carpenter top five?
Yeah. I would probably, my top one's probably They Live, I guess. And then a huge Big Trouble in Little China fan too, actually. I think that's a really good one.
Yeah.
And then probably Escape from New York. I'm trying to think. And then I sort of like, there's a bunch of, like, I'd probably put Assault on Precinct 13, The Thing are definitely very high up there for me right now, especially just sort of from recency bias and stuff like that. I should mention, I know my co-host on Space Spinner, Alex, would mention Dark Star as well. That's one of his favorite movies, actually. So sort of, man, John Carpenter's just, he's got a lot of hits. Like, he's got misses as well. I can't stress that enough, but like, he definitely has... There's some good choices in here if you're looking for fun movies to watch on a Saturday or something like that, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, all those films we've just mentioned are astonishing, and I sort of want to go off and watch them now, having just watched these two. I'll quickly mention there was a 2011 prequel, which I have rewatched for this podcast. This was the one where they explain what happened on the Norwegian base that led to the infection of Outpost 31. It's all right. It's interesting, isn't it, Troy? It's not great.
Yeah, it's I think if it was a film on its own, if it wasn't associated with John Carpenter's The Thing, it would be a fine sci-fi horror film in its own right. But yeah, it's okay. The special effects are a bit waff, to be honest, and we were discussing that earlier. Like, they originally made it with practical effects, and then the studio decided they wanted to go get rid of the practical effects and replace it with CGI. And it's really bad television level CGI, where like stuff's just kind of floating on the screen. It's not really there, and it looks a bit bit naff, to be honest.
I thought Mary Elizabeth Winstead was good as the female lead. Yeah. But like yourself, as soon as the CGI effects start, I sort of lost interest.
Yeah.
They just don't look real.
So,
yeah. Okay. The thing is obviously widely available. I've got a DVD or a Blu-ray version. I think there's some lovely Blu-ray versions with extra artwork on them and all sorts of extra features. I'm going to guess again that it's three thumbs up from us here on the Film Club. Oh, Troy's got two thumbs again. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Solid films. I can't believe anybody who's listening has not seen The Thing. But you might not have seen Assault on Precinct 13, one of Carpenter's earlier works made on a shoestring budget and remarkable. They're both great, these films, aren't they, guys?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. This is definitely like a... in some of our previous film clubs, we've had like maybe one really solid one and maybe one that might be a little bit more missable or something like that. But this one, I can wholeheartedly recommend both films. Like, you know, especially if you want to be... just to see good things, but also I think if you want to be in the mindset of your sort of early 2000 AD and just of the 2000 AD like DNA that we talk about a lot, like I think that I think both of these movies give you some big insights into like what's in the prog as well, and what sort of some of these, like, if not directly inspiring, like what sort of, I guess, what we'd say now, on the vision board of a lot of these sort of both the golden age of 2080 and just sort of in general. Like, you know, I would say that I would say a lot of John Carpenter actually is sort of part of the required reading to kind of get what's going on with 2000 AD. I think he's a very, very influential on this genre of comic, on this like genre, and this like specific piece of comics that we're looking at specifically.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, two splendid films on the Film Club. Yeah, as you say, we've had some ups and downs. I do forget we had a great discussion about Jaws, which also got past your horror band.
Listen, I'll do some. You know, like, it's okay. Like, I'm basically a scaredy cat, but I can man up a little bit if there's content to be made, you know. But it's definitely one of these, having seen The Thing, I doubt that I would put it on at Christmas versus I don't know, even in comparison to say Gremlins or something, which is also a horror film, but I think has a little bit more comedic elements and stuff, is a little bit more of a fun time, I guess, as opposed to The Thing, which for me felt like hard going a little, which was good, but also kind of hard going also.
Lots of us watch Die Hard at Christmas. Troy, do you watch The Thing at Christmas?
Yeah. It's definitely one of my...
Christmas regulars.
Yeah, one of my Christmas playlist films. I have a kind of a weird relationship with Christmas movies. I don't watch Christmas movies apart from Die Hard. Everything else is like, it's either a James Bond film or it's a war film, and those are my Christmas films.
I was going to say, I feel like from the outside, I've got a feeling of English Christmas movies that many like in the canon is like the complete James Bond and like The Great Escape and other things like that as well, in terms of what we're watching for Christmas at Christmas time and stuff.
Great stuff. So, reminder, if you have a film that you can link to British comics in any way at all, if you can find us, if you want to sneak a horror film past Conrad's radar, or if you want to argue with a confident man, then maybe you can join the Megacity Film Club by emailing mcbcpodcast@gmail.com. Guys, let's tell people where they can find you on the web. Troy.
Best place to find me would be on Instagram as either TM Fitness UK or Sweet Nightmares Media, and also Sweet Nightmares Media on Substack, where I write about films and comics and stuff like that.
If you're interested in The Thing and writing about it, then Sweet Nightmare Media on Substack. You've written some good stuff for that.
Thank you.
Conrad.
Space Spinner 2000. It's a podcast about 2000 AD. We're on a hiatus right now, but should hopefully be back soon, talking about getting into 1996 and all the craziness happens in there. It's Prog 1000 beckons, you know, a bunch of other stuff. It should be a great time. And, you know, we've still got the first 18 or so years of 2000 AD in there. If you want to check it out, we love having folks come check, come listen to our show.
And we've hinted at it. There will be a brief Conrad appearance in the UK coming up later this year.
That's right. Counting down to the Lawless convention. I just got my visa last night. So two nights ago or so. We're locked in. It's going to be amazing. Yeah. If you're in Lawless, come say hello. We'll have pints. I'm going to have so many chips in England. It's what I've missed the most.
Pints, chips, and a very tense blood test sequence.
Absolutely.
And you can find me at megacitybookclub.com, where you'll also find links to Troy's work and to Conrad's work and the email in case you want to get in touch and come and join the film club. Great fun, guys. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Until next time, I've been Eamon.
I'm Conrad.
I'm Troy.
Or are we? And we may have been...
Megacity Film Club!